Man, I'm just so grateful to be sober, guys. I had the honor of picking up John from the airport, and not in a million years would I think that I'd be doing this. And if there's anything I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know one thing. This moment right here needs as little of me as possible. So as we were driving, we could have been swapping war stories and everything, but we were swapping different stories of a different kind. And I was looking out my windshield, and I noticed something, that the windshield is far greater than my little rearview mirror. So where I'm heading in life is a lot better than where I came from. And that's what we focused on today. So with a lot of love, I introduce John from Orlando.
Hello, everybody. My name's John, and I'm a real alcoholic. God, I couldn't have had a better host than Jay. And I'm saying, man, this guy is great. But then he kept Jerry's sponsor, and I met Jerry's sponsor, and I'm saying, man, it's just great sponsorship shows up. It all starts from the beginning. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talk about you will meet lifelong friends. And I met Jay and his girl, his fiance, and Jerry and his wife, and what's your name? Butch. Me and Butch hit it off, and I know Linda. Where's Linda at? Linda, and I met the taper and his wife, and I'm saying, man, I know these people forever. I'm your friend to the end now. It's amazing. And I was sitting here, and I was looking out in the audience, and I was thinking, I said, this is the best-looking group of drunks I've ever seen. You know, everybody sitting there nice, all in place, nobody laying under the chair. Man, I said, we're going to have a good time here this weekend. Everybody got it together. There's a spirit here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard a guy one time say that he was at a meeting. And he heard a guy say, on my way to the cemetery, I stopped into an AA meeting. And that's kind of the way I got here. I felt like I was on my way to the cemetery. And the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous was the last thing and the only thing that could have helped me. And I stopped in. And I see this power in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. I'm at meetings and I see young women come in the meetings. And they've been out prostituting their bodies. And they've been on drugs and they've lost their children. And they just tore up and they said, I don't know how I can do this. I don't got nothing to live for. And then I see young men come in and they've been living under the bridge or they've been sleeping in their cars. They don't got a job and they've been out drugging and they say, man, I don't know what's the use. I get here and I can't keep it together. And then sometime I see those same young women. They come in the meeting and they say, I got 6 months now and I got visitation rights with my children again. And some of them say, I got custody of my children again. And I see the young men come in, and you don't even know who they are anymore. They come in with a different set of clothing, speaking a different language. And the language they're speaking is the language of the heart. They come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they take directions, and we give them the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it changed their lives. And, you know, what is that? I mean, the steps are just written on a piece of paper. There's a spirit that lies here, and I like to call that spirit God. Because I've seen it bring so many men and women, including myself, back from the grave. You know, we in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, we hear people's stories and we identify. There's a guy in Las Vegas, one of my heroes, and he tells a story about these rats. I told him, this is the last time I'm giving credit for this story. So if you see me speaking somewhere else, it won't be his story. But he was talking about some rats, and he said these scientists came up with the idea that they wanted to study these rats, and they hooked some electrodes up to the pleasure center of the rat's brain, the get high spot, and they put the pedal in that cage, and the rat went over and hit that pedal. And he realized when he hit that pedal that he would get high. So the rat laid on the pedal. So they thought, well, if we put some cheese in there, and I'm quite sure it was some gourmet cheese, that he would stop and eat some of this cheese. But the rat looked at the cheese like it didn't exist and laid on the paddle. And they thought, well, he should be dehydrated by now. Maybe if we give him a little water, he'll stop and drink some water. And the rat looked at the water like it didn't exist. And one of them got smart and said, I tell you what we'll do. We'll put a female rat in, Miss Rat. So they put Miss Rat in the cage, and he looked at Miss Rat like she didn't exist. And the rat laid on the paddle until he died. So the scientist said, well, we'll do this again, but what we'll do right before he die, we'll cut off the juice. So they went through the same process, you know, with the water, with the cheese, with Miss Rat, and right before he died, they cut off the juice. And when they cut off the juice, the rat hit the paddle, and nothing happened. He hit the paddle again, and nothing happened. And he went over to the corner of that cage, and he balled up in a fetal position to die. And this is what the rat thought. Without the juice, what's the use? And I heard that story, and I say, I'm that rat. I'm that rat. Because April the 18th of 1998, in Brevard County Jail, I laid in a bed in a fetal position, wishing that I could die. I wanted the end to come, kind of like in a vision for you, in that jump off place. I realized I couldn't live with it and I couldn't live without it. And I wanted the end to come. See, I know how it feels to look at the man in the mirror and you can't identify the man in the mirror anymore. When you get tired of looking at the man you're seeing in the mirror, it's time to make a change. And I wanted to change, but I didn't know how to change. You know, I'm going to tell you, I don't know, I get off on these animal stories sometime, and one time I was over to Lee house. Some of y'all know Lee. Lee sponsored me when I first came to Alcoholic Anonymous. And I was at Lee house, and we was watching the news. And there was a guy was taking a tiger to Vieira Zoo. And the tiger had almost ripped the guy's hand off. Now, I'm quite sure that they don't give you a tiger without a set of instructions. And the instructions probably went like this. Keep your hands clear of the cage. But somewhere in the midst of that, the guy consumed some alcohol. And he thought sticking his hand in that tiger's mouth was a good idea. And I'm looking at the news and I'm saying, I'm that guy. How many times have I had my hands in the tiger's mouth? I remember one time they let me out of jail and they say, if you go to the probation office tomorrow and do a clean urinalysis test and do a PSI, you don't have to go to prison. We'll give you 5 years probation. By the time I got home from the jailhouse, the idea came to me that I could have one Budweiser. And I guess you know my family seen me 5 years later. I like to watch the animal channels. I'm off with these things, and I like to watch the Animal Kingdom channel. And sometimes they have those gazelles, right? And then it get about dark, right when it start getting dark, they all get in a circle. And the lion be standing over there watching them, right? And then when he wait until they get a good tight circle, and he strikes. And I noticed that lion always get the one to the edge. And that's the way that the lion, the disease of alcoholism is. When it strikes, it get the one to the edge of the circle. See, we got to get in the middle of this deal. And when we get in the middle of this deal, we got to stay in the middle of this deal. We got to make this deal our home. My sobriety date is April the 18th of 1998. I'm a member of the Central Group of Orlando. If you're ever in Orlando and you want to have a good meeting with some real alcoholics, we sit right off of I-4 and the corner of Colonial. Stop in and we'll be more than glad to have you there. When I first got out of prison, I hadn't connected back with my family, and it was Christmas time. And I told Lee, I said, Lee, I don't know what I'm going to do. It's Christmas time, and I haven't connected back with my family. He said, John, you got plenty of family down at Central. We'll go down to Central. So he picked me up about 10 o'clock that Christmas morning, and we went to Central. And I got to Central, man, and I could smell the aroma from that food. And we was in a meeting. I'm saying, man, is this meeting going to ever come to an end? So finally the meeting came to an end. And I got up, man, and I fixed me a nice plate. I got me some of the greens they had, some turkey, some ham, some cornbread, and macaroni and cheese. See, that was an upgrade for my eating. They didn't feed you like that in DOC. So when I got my plate fixed, I looked at Lee and I said, who do I pay for this? Lee said, John, you don't have to pay for this. This is for free. See, that was new to me. Where I had came from, nothing was for free. Everything had a price tag on it. And this is the way he used to introduce me to guys when I used to go to a lot of meetings with him when I first got out of prison. He'd get me to the meeting and he said, meet John. He one of them bad kind of alcoholics. And I said, man, this guy gonna have everybody thinking I'm the worst guy in the world. And I just kept coming around the room to hear some of y'all's stories. And I said, now these some bad alcoholics. You know, I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. And the reason I say I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety, my friends told me so. My family told me so. Brevard County Sheriff Department told me so. Even the statistics was against me. The statistics say that 90% of the men get out of prison return within the first year. But since I've been in the program of Alcoholic Anonymous, I hadn't had the obsession to commit the type of crimes that land me in prison. It's been 13 years since I had to jump a fence. Now when I see a police officer, I don't see him as my enemy. I see him as an outstanding citizen doing a fine job in society. You know, being an alcoholic of a hopeless variety, you have some things to happen. I remember once I didn't have any driver license, so I used to ride a bike. And I was riding that bike one night, and a police officer pulled up on side of me. He said, stop. And I was trying to stop, but the bike didn't have any brakes. So when I finally got the bike stopped, the guy jumped out and wrestled me to the ground and put handcuffs on me and took me to jail. The next morning, they took me in front of the judge, and the judge said, read this gentleman's charge, and they charged me with fleeing and eluding a police officer on a bicycle. The judge thought it was funny, too, and he throwed it out. I used to have I had an automobile. I had my driver's license was suspended, but I still had an automobile. And I lived about 3 or 4 blocks from the store. And I said, ain't no way the police going to get me before I get to the store if I just go there and come right back. And so I biked out the driveway, and I got about a block, maybe a block and a half, and the blue lights came on me. And I didn't have driver license, but I knew my brother's date of birth and social security number. So the police officer came up and he said, can I see your driver license? I said, I don't have any. He said, do you have an ID? I said, no, sir. He said, what's your date of birth and social security, your name, date of birth and social security number? So instantly I became Larcel Hunter. I gave my brother's name, date of birth and social security number. He went back to the car and he ran it. He came back and tapped on the window. I said, yes, sir. He said, Mr. Hunter, would you step out the car? So I stepped out the car, and he began to put handcuffs on me. And I asked him, I said, well, what are you doing? He said, you're $18,000 behind in child support. I'm not going to stand at this podium tonight and tell you that my childhood and my past made me an alcoholic. Usually to become an alcoholic, you have to drink a little whiskey. But when I got the whiskey, it sure did help me with my childhood and my past. I was born in a little town called Statesboro, Georgia. My father was a sharecropper. My mother was a Southern Baptist. My mother taught me everything any good mother would teach her child. She made me go to Bible study during the week. She made me go to Sunday school on Sunday mornings. She made me go to church on Sunday evenings. My mom even sat me down and taught me the golden rules. She told me, baby, if you're going to make it in this world, you're going to have to learn to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But about the age of 9, something happened. My mom passed away. And when my mom passed away, all that passed away. My father was a chronic alcoholic. There was times I went to school on a wet, cold ground with holes in the bottom of my shoes. There was times I went to bed hungry at night. There was times I went to school and my clothes wasn't so too good and kids would make fun of me. So low self-esteem sat in right away. And I thought I could do things to get the teacher's approval, and that didn't even work. And I had older sisters and brothers. And I knew if I made it to their house, everything was going to be all right. And I would get to their homes and they would put me down. So I felt inferior to, less than everything and everybody at a real young age. I can remember my father coming up in the car, and I always had a decision to make. Was I going to help my father, or was I going to leave him out there and not be embarrassed in front of my friends? And my father would come up in that car, and I would hear his car horn blowing. And my decision was always this. I was going to help my father no matter what. And I would go out to that car and get my father and begin to help him in the house. And I would hear the kids say, look at John. He got to drag his drunk dad in the house again. So I felt that those kids were better than me. There was times I used to be sitting looking out my bedroom window, and I would see other kids out in the yard playing catch ball with their father, catch football with their father, or wrestling around in the yard. And I would instantly say, what kind of God would take a 9-year-old boy's mother? Instantly, I would blame God because I didn't have that. But standing to this podium tonight, I have to let God off the hook, because God left me with a father that wasn't willing to step up to the plate. About the age of 14, I got interested in girls. What do? You get interested in girls. You go to those little teen centers. And I said, man, I'm going to the teen center. And I'd get dressed and I'd go to the teen center and I'd get to that teen center. And those girls would be smelling good, man, and they would be looking good. And I said, man, I'm going to dance with me some of these girls tonight. That song will come on and go off, and the next song I'll dance with one after this song go off. And then I'd look out across the floor, and there'll be some guy out there with a pair of Chuck Taylors and Levi's on, and he'd have a circle of girls around him. How many of y'all know about Chuck Taylors and Levi's? That's old school. I said, that's what it is. It's in the Chuck Taylors and Levi's. And I work and save my money up, man. I just know I got the right ingredients to go to the dance with now. And I get to that dance. How many of y'all know I was a guy standing up against the wall with a pair of Chuck Taylors and Levi's on? See, there was something on the inside of me that wouldn't let me respond to the things on the outside of me. My father came up with this great idea. He said, you ought to go spend some time with your aunt and uncle this summer. And I came back to Statesboro. And my aunt and uncle had two boys a little older than me. And one Saturday night, they asked me, did I want to go to the dance? And I told them, yeah. And we got in this little farm model truck, and down the dirt road we went. And they got to this little old house, and they got out and knocked on the door, and an elderly guy came to the door. And they asked him, would he sell us a pint of moonshine? And he went back and came back with a pint of moonshine in an MD 2020 bottle. If any of y'all know about bootlegging, you know that combination. So he gave us that pint of moonshine. One of the brothers took a swallow and passed it to me. I told him, I don't want that. The other brother took a swallow, and we went on to the dance. When we got to the dance, the other brother took a swallow and passed it to me. I said, man, I don't want that. He said, man, take a drink of this. This stuff will make you feel good. And I took me a big swallow. And I can remember it just like it was yesterday. Dr. Silkworth said, you shall remember. You know what? I love carrot cake, but I don't remember my first slice. There was something special about that first drink of whiskey. You know, most people, if moonshine was their first drink, they would have spit it back out. But when that moonshine hit my mouth, the glands in my mouth began to water. There was a warm, smooth, burning feeling went down. And when it hit the pits of my stomach, it felt like my stomach expanded. My head exploded. It felt like I was 10 feet tall, bulletproof, and instantly good looking. Remember I say I was shy about dancing with girls? I danced with them all that night, man. I had it going on. And guess what? There was no low self-esteem that night. That liquor brought me from a place from which I had never been able to visit from before. And you know what? For a long time, whiskey wasn't my problem. Alcohol was my answer. And it was the only answer I had until I made it here to you all. I went back home that summer, and some of my friends had been doing some drinking too. And we'd get together and pool our money together in the morning, and we would buy alcohol. And sometimes we'll buy some other little substances. You know, in my talk tonight, I may say something about drugs one or two times. And I don't belong in Narcotic Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm at home. Right now, if you put a pile of crack up here in front of me, I'd call the police on you. You give me a drink of whiskey, and I'd kill you about that same pile of crack. See, when I drink alcohol, I become open to everything. And I used to wear a leather jacket. And there was times we didn't have money. And I could put 3/5 of MD-2020 in the back of that leather jacket, and you'd never know it. So instantly, as soon as I start drinking, I start stealing for it. And sometimes me and my friends would be hanging out at night. And they said, man, we got to go to school tomorrow. And I tell them to drop me off, and I'll continue to drink. How many of y'all know you can't stay in school long drinking MD-2020? So it wasn't long before I was expelled, and my father and sister said, you ain't got no education. You need to go to Job Corps. I agreed. I went to Job Corps. I did good in Job Corps for about 2 weeks. After I started drinking, I didn't do good at nothing no more than 2 weeks. So for about 2 weeks, I did good, and then they let me out on a Liberty trip. And there was a guy on the bus said, John. I said, yeah. He said, this bus will ride a half a gallon of liquor. I told him, quit playing. He said, you know I don't play. So when we got to Knoxville, Tennessee, we went and got a half a gallon of rum. And there was a tire flipped up under that bus, and we put that half a gallon of rum up in that tire. When we got back to the Job Corps Center, that rum was there. After a couple of trips like that, how many of y'all know you can't stay in Job Corps drinking rum? So they booted me out of Job Corps, and on my way home, I made up my mind that I was going to live the way I wanted to live. See, I wasn't afraid of my father anymore. I wasn't afraid of my sisters and brothers anymore. Alcohol had gave me all the courage I needed, and I felt like I was ready for the world. When I got home, I began to hang with the drug dealers. I began to sell drugs. I was able to buy a few toys. I was able to dress good. Most of all, I was able to drink the way I wanted to drink. Tom Collins, Scotch Collins, Hennessy, Ballantine. I had fun drinking for a long time. See, my story is different from a lot of people's stories. A lot of people say alcohol quit working for them. Alcohol never quit working for me. My last drink did the same thing for me my first one did. I just got tired of the consequences. Somewhere in life, I crossed the invisible line, a place of no return. The police began to get mad with me, and they would put me in jail for periods of time. And I would get to jail, and I say, you know, when I get out of here, it's going to be different. I'm going to go back to school, get me an education. I'm going to get me a girlfriend, buy me a car. I'm going to do the right thing when I get out of jail. And the day would come when they would let me out of jail. And I get just about a mile from that bus stop, and the disease of alcoholism began to speak to me. And it sounded something like this. It's been a long time since you had a beer. One won't hurt. And I'd buy that beer and drink that beer with the mindset of having just one beer. And I'd be off and running until the next time. There was times they would put me in prison for periods of time. And I'd be in prison and I'd write my family. And I'd tell my family, I found religion. I'm a saved man now. I walk after the things of God. And my family would believe me. I believed me. And if they had gave me a lie detector test, I would have passed it because I meant business. But there was one thing wrong with the whole thing. When they let me out of prison, they let me out of prison. And that's a scary thing. And it would be a couple weeks before my family would see me. And when my family would see me, they'd say, you know, you're the biggest liar we know. But what my family didn't understand, I was doing the best that the disease of alcoholism would allow me to do. My appearance began to fail. My family used to come up on the street corner to pick me up. And they come up on that street corner and they say, why don't you just come go home with us? If it ain't but for one day, give yourself a break. And I look in that car and I see all that pain in their faces. And I say, man, I gotta quit hurting them like this. And I get in that car and I look up in that rearview mirror at their faces and I say, man, I can't keep doing this to them. And they'd stop to a store somewhere and buy me some clothes, so I'd have clean clothes to put on. And they'd take me to their home, allow me to have a warm shower, give me clean clothes to put on, give me a clean bed to sleep in. And I'd walk by and I'd be looking at them and I'd say, I can't keep hurting them like this. And about the third day, I begin to get irritable and discontent. And I say, I'm going up to the store just to get me a beer to take the edges off. And I go up to that store and get that beer, and I'd be off and running. Remember, that's the family that I said I love. That's the family that I swore on the oath I wouldn't hurt anymore. But I couldn't stop drinking. You know what? If anybody tried to do something to my family, I would die for them. But you give me a drink of whiskey, I'll be the first person to hurt them. The first person to hurt them. I met this woman, and she told me, she said, Melbourne is what keeping you drunk. We need to move to Atlanta. And I agreed with her. I said, yeah, change. Sometimes the change of cities bring about a difference. But the only thing happened is when I got to Atlanta, see, her mom helped her got a job. Her stepfather helped me got a job. They helped us got an apartment. But there was one thing wrong with Atlanta. Atlanta sold whiskey, too. And, I crushed those people hard and just everything they tried to do for me, I destroyed it. I was working at a company. Some of y'all may have heard of it. Used to be a company here called Video Ingram out in the Norcross area. So I used to work for Video Ingram. And there was a guy in Video Ingram that had a toy poodle. Me and him became friends. And he told me that that toy poodle was bad about chewing electrical cords. And one night he forgot to unplug a lamp. And that toy poodle got hold of that lamp wire. He said, you can hear that dog holler all over the house. I said, yeah, I said. He said, John, when I go back home now, and I wave that cord at him, guess what he do? I said, well, what do we do? He said, man, that dog holler all over again. That dog had more sense than me. He didn't want no more of the thing that was hurting him. Guess what? That poodle never had the obsession to chew another electrical cord. But you take me. Alcohol can beat me up one side, tear me down the other side, cause me to lose the best relationship I ever had, put more space between me and my family than there ever been, cause me to lose my little girl out of my life, and put me in deep prison deeper than I've been. And when I get out of prison, if you wave a ball at me, I'll do it again. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous said that our dilemma is a lack of power. I have no defense against the first drink. It must come from a power greater than me. I getting close to the end, my sister used to come on the street corner, and she had an insurance policy. And she had tears in her eyes, and she begged me to sign that insurance policy. She said, I need something to bury you with. The way you're living out here, you can't keep living like that. And I signed the insurance policy. You know, a few months ago, I was at my sister's home, and we got up that morning, and I began to we was having a cup of coffee together, and my sister began to cry. And I asked her, I said, well, what's wrong? She said, since you've been in A&A, that's what she said, when I hear an ambulance at night or a police siren, I don't have to jump out of my bed and get on my knees and pray. Because ever since you've been in AA, I know that you're all right now. And I remember when my sister used to try to help me. I used to tell her to stay out of my business. If I'm doing anything, I'm only doing it to myself. It's you know, we think we're not hurting anybody but ourselves, but we take everybody that's close to us hostage when we're in the midst of this disease. And I got a chance to make amends with my sister then, and I was able to tell her I didn't know that I was hurting her. And what could I do to make that right? God gave me an opportunity to set things straight with her. Getting toward the end, I used to walk late at night. And sometimes I have a pocket full of money, a pocket full of drugs, and a bottle of booze. And I would ask God, God, if I'm going to ever change, you're going to have to help me change. And I prayed that prayer for about 3 weeks, and my house was surrounded by Brevard County Sheriff Department. And that morning, I met a power greater than myself. And They took me out my family house, and my family neighbors was outside, and I look back at my family, and I could see all that shame and pain in their faces. And I was looking out the back of that police window, and I was trying to tell my family that I love them, because I thought it was the end for me. I did not know that April the 18th of 1998 was the beginning of a brand new life. They took me to jail. They kept me in jail for about 30 days. A public defender came to see me. The public defender said, "Mr. Hunter, they got you to the right this time." The state attorney is asking for 30 years on each sentence. He don't want to run them concurrent. He want to run them consecutive. And the public defender got up to walk away. And I said, "Wait a minute." He looked back at me and shook his head as if there ain't nothing I can do for you. About 30 to 60 more days, they took me to court. And I was in the holding cell. And I seen the public defender and the state attorney come out the courtroom door at the same time. And I'm thinking, have this guy butted up with the state attorney? And when they got to my cell, the state attorney bent over to the chute and said, "Mr. Hunter, I got you to the right this time. If you plea out the 30 years, I run the other 30 concurrent." And the state attorney got up, walked away. He was so sure about what he had on me. So the public defender bent to the chute and said, "Mr. Hunter, I think it's a good deal. You ought to take it." And I bent to the chute and told him, "You take it." So they took me in front of the judge, and the judge asked me, he said, "Mr. Hunter, how do you plea?" And I said, "Your Honor, I plead to the mercy of the court." And the state attorney said, "Hold on a minute, Your Honor, I want to show you something." And he pulled up a video set, and he stuck the tape in the video, and it was me as plain as day. And the judge said, "Mr. Hunter, with your record and this video, I'll probably go along with the state." I said, "Your Honor, if I get that type of time today, I won't accept it from the state. You'll have to give it to me." He hit the table. Bam, get him out of here, recess. When I got in that holding cell, I got on my knees and I asked God, "If I get that type of time today, God, let it be your will and not theirs." About an hour went by, they came and got me, took me back in the courtroom. And the judge asked the public defender to approach the bench with the habitual papers. He did. He asked the state attorney to approach the bench with the habitual papers. He did. But the judge kept flipping through his folder. And he said, "I can't find them." And the public defender said, "Your Honor, would you state that a little clearer for the record?" He said, "I can't find them. But I'm going to give Mr. Hunter every day that I could give him by law." And by law, all he could give me was 5 years in the Department of Correction, followed by 4 years probation. If the habitual papers isn't in the judge's folder 30 days prior to sentencing a man, he can't sentence him as a habitual criminal. See, there's not a second guess in my mind why I'm in Marietta, Georgia tonight. I'm in Marietta, Georgia tonight because the loving God looked down upon me and showed grace and mercy. I told you about the video. If I got what I deserved, you'd have a different speaker up here tonight. They took me back to jail with the 5 years and 4 months and the 5 years in prison followed by 4 years probation. And I stayed in jail another week or two, and they took me to the Department of Correction. When I got to prison, I used to walk around the recreational yard. And I stayed, after those 5 years in prison, I stayed in prison 4 years and 3 months. And I used to pray the same prayer for 4 years and 3 months walking around that recreational yard. I used to look up at that razor wire, and I said, "God, you didn't make me to be caged up like a wild animal. And I'm not asking you to get me out of here because I'm guilty of what they say I did. What I'm asking you, God, is when I get out of here, you help me to be a better person. Help me be a blessing to my family and not a hindrance." Shortly after that, I was forced into a TIA program. I met a counselor by the name of Mr. Elkins. Mr. Elkins, some days he act like he liked me, and some days he act like he didn't like me too well. So one day I just said, "Well, Mr. Elkins ain't liking me too good today." He called me out in front of the group, and he said, "John, do you think you're powerless over alcohol and your life was unmanageable?" I said, "Mr. Elkins, why are you calling me out in front of the group? We've had plenty of one-on-ones." He said, "I didn't call you out, convict. I asked you a question. Approach my desk." I approached Mr. Elkins' desk, and he had a book in his hand. And when I got there, Mr. Elkins shoved that book in my hand, and he said, "I challenge you to read this book." I went back on the compound, and at count time, I opened that book, and I began to read it, and I read about 3 or 4 pages. And then it asked me a question. It asked me, had I ever been defeated for defeated by alcohol. And God gave me a moment of clarity. I can remember the times I promised my daughter I was going to take her to Disney. But the night before, I drank and drug my money up. I can remember when I had an eviction notice. And I had the money to pay my rent, but I drank and drug that money up and I got evicted. I can remember the time when I used to like to fish. But due to drugs and alcohol, I didn't own a reel or rod or any tackle anymore. I can remember the time when a woman and two little kids was living in the house with me. And we had the final notice on the light bill. And with everything in me, I was going to pay that light bill the next morning so that that woman and kids didn't have to be in the dark. But in the midst of the night, that drink thing hit me. And I just wanted one to take the edges off. Y'all know the rest of the story. The woman and the little kids had to live with me under candlelight. The next morning, I went back and Mr. Elkins looked at me and he could see something was wrong. And he took me in the office by myself and he said, John, what's wrong? And I said, Mr. Elkins, alcohol became my master and I was its slave. He said, John, I've been hearing it come out your mouth. He said, but this morning I hear it coming from your heart. He said, now you got a place to start. Mr. Elkins worked steps with me in a short form. Shortly after that, they got me and they took me over to Tomoka Correctional Institution. And when I got to Tomoka Correctional Institution, there was two guys used to bring me in an AA meeting. If anybody going to corrections, it's very much needed. And you do get a guy every now and then. I'm the result of a guy coming in bringing an AA meeting into a prison. I don't know where my life would be if Elmer hadn't have brought a meeting into a prison. Elmer brought that meeting in, and Elmer told me, he said, John, an alcoholic of your nature, if you don't put your feet in the rooms of Alcoholic Anonymous as soon as you get out of prison, I can almost guarantee you you'll drink again. He said, if you argue about with yourself whether you can and can't drink, he said, you probably will. Elmer scared me. He scared me enough to do something about it. I wrote the Recovery House of Central Florida in Sanford, Florida. I asked them up on release from prison, could I come to the Recovery House? They wrote me back and said they'd be more than glad to have me to stop in. So after being in prison for 4 years and 3 months, I signed myself up in a halfway house for another year. I called my family after I got settled in at the halfway house. They said, we thought you was getting out today. I said, I'm out. They said, well, where are you? I said, I signed myself up in a halfway house for another year. They said, you know what? You the biggest fool we know. After staying in prison 4 years and 3 months, you're going to put yourself away for another year? But what was happening is that my family couldn't see my fear. It had been the age of 14 since I had been sober in society. And I was willing to go to any length this time, no matter what. I was willing to do whatever I needed to do to be sober this time. The scary thing about that is that there's a part of me that loved that madness out there. And if I expose that part of me to that madness, I'll go out there and I'll stay. I'm an alcoholic that has to do what's necessary in the rooms of Alcoholic Anonymous in order to maintain my sobriety. I was at the halfway house, and every week a guy used to bring a big book study in. And one night, one Thursday night, he didn't do a big book study. He told his story. And when he told his story, I heard my story. And I asked him, would he show me how to stay sober? He said, I can't show you how to stay sober, but I'll show you what they showed me. He sat me down at the kitchen table, and we talked about the first three steps. And then he took me to page 98 of the big book of Alcoholic Anonymous. The second paragraph, it said, burn this idea into the conscience of every man that he could get sober in spite of anyone under these conditions. That he trusts God and clean house. He said, John, I see that you trust God. Now it's time for you to clean house. He took me in his Jeep and he took me across the street and he brought a notebook tablet. And he brought me back to the table and he drew three lines on that paper. And he said, right here, I want you to tell me what, write down the name of all the people you hate. The resentment list. Don't you know I remember them all? When he got back the next week, I had that done. And then he told me, he said, now, John, I want you to tell me why you hate them. The cause. Don't you know I remember what they done to me? And then the next week he came back, he flipped the script on me. He told me he wanted me to pray for him. I said, what? He said, yeah, I want you to pray for him. He said, John, you better mean business. He said, we're doing a spiritual step right now, and you better mean business if you want to get connected with God. I said, okay, I'll do it. I'll pray for them. I pray that the kids be college graduates. I pray that they made enough money to support their families, that their marriages was happy. And some of them I couldn't pray for, and I asked God, if you want me to love this one, you got to love him through me so the love can be made perfect. He came back, and he said, how you doing with that prayer? I said, I'm good, all but two people. I can't get past. And he say, have you really prayed? I say, no, I've really prayed, and I can't get past them. And he said, John, who is the two people? And I told him, my father who treated me so poorly as a child. And the girl who shot me in my back with the hunting rifle and caused me to lose my right lung. And I swore if I lived, I'd get even with both of them. And he told me, he said, John, have a seat. And I sat down. He said, John, I want you to think of three of the worst things you ever did. And I thought of three of the worst things I ever did. And he said, John, do you think you should be forgiven? I said, yes, I think I should be forgiven. He said, John, I think you should be forgiven too. He said, John, the reason why you did what you did were because you were spiritually sick. The reason why your father and that girl did what they did to you were because they were spiritually sick. That was good news to me that my father was spiritually sick. That meant that my father wasn't the type of man would send his 9-year-old boy out on a wet, cold ground with holes in the bottom of his shoes. That meant that my father wasn't the type of man would send me to school with dirty clothes. That meant that my father wasn't the type of man would send me to bed hungry at night. That meant that my father was caught in the grip of an obsession that no human power could have relieved him of. How can I hate a man like that when I became the same man? See, here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't hate spiritually sick people. We pray for them. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous say that resentment is our number one offender. We must rid ourselves of resentment or it kills us. A resentment for me is like me taking that cup, filling it up with poison, and drinking it, but waiting for you all to die. See, all those years I was dying on the inside, and nobody knew it but me. Me and Jay was riding, and Jay asked me what, I just thought of Jay when I got to this part of my talk. Jay asked me what type of music I like to listen at, and I told him I like to listen at a little gospel and a little R&B. Well, I listened to an R&B artist by the name of Betty Wright, and Betty Wright sang a song called No Pain, No Gain. And I was listening to that Betty Wright one morning. She said, if you can receive the gift to forgive, a longer and a better life you'll live. No pain, no gain. I said, that sounds like AA talk. So I rewinded, and sure enough, she said it again. If you can receive the gift to forgive, a longer and a better life you'll live. No pain, no gain. Okay, what are you saying? Is that when I forgive somebody else, I get set free? Is that what you're saying? When I set one of God's kids free, I get free. Isn't that something? See, when we hate a person, that's taking. When we pray for a person, that's giving. I never seen anybody give spiritually and not receive. But this is the part that stood out the most to me. She said, if I can receive as though I don't already have the gift to forgive, I have to receive. You mean I don't have the power to forgive? No. Forgiveness comes from God through me when I become a willing vessel to let things go. Isn't that something? Whenever I begin to, you know what? This is how I find forgiveness. I ask God to let it go. A lot of times, God, I don't want it. God, this is one of your kids that I feel this way about. Would you please help me not feel this way anymore? And then I'm able to set that person free, and then I'm able to get free. I remember doing my fifth step. I told my sponsor everything. I didn't know if he was going to call the police or not. But I knew I didn't want to get drunk. And I knew y'all had told me half measures avail us nothing. You know, sometimes, now this is the biggest lie I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm calling it a lie only because that's what it is. I hear people tell newcomers sometimes, if you put half in, you're going to get half out. Well, I got news for you, newcomers. If you put half in, you don't get nothing out. This is an all or nothing deal. Half measures avail us nothing. If you want what we got, you got to do what we did. And I remember him asking me, he said, John, are you ready to have God move your defects of character? I said, yeah. He said, well, what are they? I said, huh? But, you know, him being the fine sponsor that he is, he had already jotted it down. He told me, he said, John, you're a liar. You're a thief. You're a deadbeat dad. You use women for your own selfish reasons. And there were some other things he told me. And he said, John, I believe that the dirtiest, rottenest thing you ever did, you did it to survive based upon the circumstances in your life. And he said, if you would give this stuff to God, God will take it. He set me free. Everybody else told me that I needed to burn in hell for my actions. And some of them tried to send me there. But he helped me get free of that. But that one thing about a character defect, don't ever fool yourself that they're gone. They have a way of popping their ugly heads back up. You know, there was a little boy one time, and his name was Little Johnny. Little Johnny was good on fixing things. So Little Johnny found the lawnmower. He painted it red and sided out by the road and put $20 on it. Here comes the old Baptist preacher on Sunday. He came by there, and he said, Johnny, why you want so much for that lawnmower? He said, that's just the prize, Rev. He said, will it crank? He said, yeah, it'll crank, Rev. So the preacher got down and stopped pulling the string. He stood up and looked at little Johnny and said, Johnny, I thought you said that lawnmower crank. He said, it will, but there's a trick to it. He said, what the trick? He said, you got to kick it, spit on it, then curse it. And the preacher said, little Johnny, I don't believe I can curse if I wanted to. I haven't cursed in so long. Johnny, have you forgot? I'm a preacher. I can't curse. And little Johnny said, if you jerk that string a few more times, it'll all come back. And if your character defects haven't been showing up, your string haven't been jerked. What a fellowship we have here, right? You know, I was writing my amend list. And my sponsor walked up and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm writing my amend list. He said, no, you're not. I said, what do you mean I'm not? He said, you remember when I asked you when you was doing your fourth step, was you selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate to any of the people? I said, yeah. He said, that's your amend list. Now, if I knew that was going to be my amend list, I wouldn't have been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate to all of them. Especially my daughter, mother. I didn't feel like I owed her anything. She took my parental rights for 9 years. But and that's the first amend he started me with. And I said, man, I don't want to do this. He said, John, let me explain something to you. It ain't about what they did to you anymore. It's about you cleaning your side of the street so that you can be a maximum service to God and others. And he said, I want you to write a letter to your daughter, mother, and to your daughter. I said, man, don't make me write this letter. If I write this letter, this is going to open up a can of worms. He said, John, write the letter. I wrote the letter, and I took the letter back. And he said, John, we're going to mail the letter. I said, man, I can't mail this letter. This letter is going to cause a lot of trouble. He said, John, let's pray over the letter. We prayed over the letter, and I mailed it. Within a week time, I got a phone call from my daughter. And she told me that she wanted to start building a new relationship with me and that she wanted to be a part of my life. She's expensive, but she's back. I mean, the gifts that we get when we do the work. I had forgot about an amend, and I was over in Melbourne, and I was riding by this store, and I used to steal a lot of MD-2020 out this store. And so the guy would come out, and he would say, give me that MD-2020, and I'd tell him, you don't want to go through that by the bottle of wine. God bless the child that tried to block me from the first drink. I'm going to get that drink of wine no matter what. And he got tired of that, and he barred me away from his store. And I was passing his store in Melbourne, and when I got by that store, it hit my mind that I owe him an amend. And instantly I thought, I can't go to that store. That guy barred me away from there. And I got about 3 more blocks, and it became the strongest thing on my mind. So I didn't question it anymore. I turned my car around. And I went back, and I pulled up in front of the store. And I got out the store, and when I opened the store door, he pointed at me and said, you're a different man. And then he said it again, you're a different man with a smile on his face. And I walked in and I told him, I done you wrong and I'm going to make it right. He said, oh, don't worry about it. And I explained to him that I was in a fellowship. And one of the requirements was that I clean up the wreckage from my past. And then he pointed at me and he said, if you made it right with God, you've already made it right with me. Again, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, step 10, I do that every night. Sit down and inventory my day and go over it. Step 11, upon awakening, I ask God to divorce me from self-pity, dishonesty, and self-seeking and give me intuitive thinking for the next 24 hours. And this is why I do that. I had a sponsor tell me that, John, in the morning time, you might serve a piece of pie and you want it to be good. He said, if you was going to bake a cake, you would put eggs in it. You would put the butter. If sugar needed, you would do that as well. So when you serve a slice of that cake, it would be good. He said that in the morning time, you're going to serve a slice of life. And you want to get up in the morning, you want to add a little meditation. You want to add a little prayer. You want to ask God that to help you understand people rather than seek to be understood. You're going to ask God to help you comfort people rather than seek to be comforted. He said, John, and I guarantee you when you go out, you'll serve a good slice of pie. And so I'm big on the morning, and that was Ed M. He sponsored me the last 4 years of his life. I do step 12. Guess what? Remember the treatment center I told you that I checked myself in? I married a lady stayed right across the street in a condo. So my wife had a condo right across the street from the treatment center, and we moved and we bought another condo now, but I was right in walking distance from the treatment center. And what I do is I sponsor a lot of guys at the treatment center. None of my sponsees have over a year. I sponsor the guys at the treatment center that can't go out and get a sponsor. So I go in and do a lot of sponsorship work there. And I'm trying to keep this thing going. You know, the 12 steps isn't designed to take away who we are. The 12 steps is designed to take away who we're not. You know, Michelangelo was in front of a church and he was chiseling on a big ugly stone. Little old lady came out and said, son, why are you chiseling on this big ugly stone? He said, because on the inside of this stone, there stands a beautiful angel. And that's the same way the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is. When it take away everything that's ugly, here's a room full of beautiful angels. Isn't that something? Where else can we get this deal at? You know, I always knew there was a spiritual solution, but what I didn't know about was the program of action. My family used to clean me up and they used to take me to church. And they would have something called an altar call. And I would look up there at that guy and I'd say, that guy offering something good. And I would go up there and he would put oil on my forehead and pray over me. And then when I left there, I couldn't pass the ABC. I'd have to stop off at the ABC. I'm not saying that God couldn't meet me at that altar. What I'm saying is that my house wasn't in order to receive the things of God. The 12 steps that haven't had a spiritual awakening, that's what? The result of these steps. Now that I don't have a problem passing the ABC. Isn't that something? See, there's a lie that centers the mind of every alcoholic that he could one day safely drink again. And if we get away from doing the things that we need to do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that lie comes alive. I got a bad bite. Some mornings I roll out of bed on my knees and I simply say this, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thy will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may bear to do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those that I may help. Of thy power, thy love, and thy will alive, may I do thy will always. What I'm asking God is to move John out of the way so I can be a maximum service to your kids. You know, the only way I can drink today, I'd have to drink off a lie. I couldn't drink off the truth. Now, I can tell myself this and get good and drunk. John, you know you look pretty good. You got an automobile. You got a wife. Your family back on your team. And you work real hard. You deserve a beer. I can drink off that. But if I say, John, now this is the truth. If I say, John, when you open this beer, you're going to open the gates to the penitentiary. You're not going to have a wife. You're not going to have an automobile because you're going to pawn it for drugs and alcohol. And they're going to put you deeper in prison than you ever been. Because that's what happened. to a guy like me when you add alcohol to him. In order for me to have a normal life, the idea that I could safely drink has got to be smashed. I try controlled drinking. It's that red look, I'll drink a little white. It's that white, I'll drink a little wine. The only way I can have a normal life is I have to abandon alcohol. I have to abandon it. I thought I was weak until I made it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and got a hold to the big book and got a hold to more about alcoholism. Bill said that most of us was unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. And then he told us how we had to get this thing. He said we must conceive in our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. And then Bill assured us we can't drink again. Bill said we're like men that have lost their legs. Once losing their legs, they don't grow new ones. Once losing the ability to control alcohol, guess what? We don't regain it. Once I found out I had alcoholism, then you all could help me. You told me I had to admit that I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. You told me that I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. You told me that the realm of the spirit was broad and roomy and that my own conception was good enough. You told me that if I didn't believe in God, that it was okay. If I was willing to believe in God, that much could be built on that. You told me that I had to make a decision to turn my life over to the will of God as I understood him. You told me that I had to get out of management because based on my management skills, if I worked for a big corporation, I'd have been fired a long time ago. And then you told me that I got to learn to live along spiritual lines or I was going to die an alcoholic death, and that God was to be my new director and that my troubles was of my own making. That he was the principal and we were the agents. He's the father and we're his children. And you told me that that concept was the keystone to the new and triumph arch from which I could pass through to freedom. And then you made me a promise. You told me if I would stay close to God and perform his work well, that God would take care of me. You know, when I came into these rooms, I bought my worst. And you gave me your best. And when I would mess up, you told me to keep coming back. Everywhere else I went told me not to come back. And, you know, I've had some of the best sponsorship that a man could have in his life. Guys that sponsor me are not guys that just talked about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're guys that live the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my mentors told me that God is like any good mother that will play hide and go seek with her child. That a good mother is going to hide where that child could find her. And when that child finds that mother, she's going to love all over it. Well, I got news for you. God is not lost. God could and would if he was sought. And when you find God, God's going to love all over you. I'm at a place in my recovery where either God is or he ain't. He's everything or he's nothing. And God's everything in my life. See, I walk by faith and not by sight. I'd rather walk with God alone in the dark than any man in the light. Y'all heard part of my story tonight. And you probably got a pretty good idea of how it was for me. But my family knew everything. And sometimes I go there and I'm having dinner with them. And my family keep watching me. And I said, what are you watching me like that for? And they said, oh, it ain't nothing. I said, oh, yeah, come on, tell me, what are you watching me like that for? They said, man, how did you do it? They know how I was terrible. They said, how did you do it? And I tell them I'm just like that old woodpecker. And they said, a woodpecker. I said, yeah, I'm just like that old woodpecker. There was a woodpecker that got up religiously every morning and went and pecked on a hardwood tree trying to get out the worms and mites. One morning he got up and went to that hardwood tree and he began to peck on it, and a dark cloud formed over that tree. And a streak of lightning came out that cloud and split that tree. And old woodpecker was able to eat all the worms and mites he wanted. And then here come a flock of woodpeckers. And they joined him, and they began to eat with him. And one of the woodpeckers looked up at him and said, how did you do it? He said, I showed up and did what I was supposed to do. And God did the rest. See, that's my story here, is that I showed up and did what I was supposed to do, and God did the rest. You know what? You helped me remember my mother in a special way. You took the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and did for me what my mother was trying to do. And now I'm not selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate with my friends. I do live the golden rules. I do unto others as I have them would have them to do unto me. You gave me my daughter bike. The family that said I was doomed, they argue about who house I'm going to go to on holidays. Isn't that something? I came in when I was at my worst. And there never was a meeting I went to that people didn't give me their best. You know, I want to tell a story about the Good Samaritan, and I'll close with this. There was a Samaritan, and I was reading it in a book, and they say there was a guy on the side of the road that had been robbed. And there were some religious people came by, and they were called Levites. And here's what the Levites thought. If we can't help this guy, Levites can't touch unclean things. What is going to happen to us if we help him? And they passed him by. And some normal folks came by, and they looked upon the guy, and they didn't know where the robbers was at. And instantly they thought, well, what's going to happen to us if we help him? And they passed him by. And then a Samaritan came by, and he flipped the script. What's going to happen to this guy if I don't help him? We got to be the good Samaritans here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. What's going to happen to the newcomer that come through that door if we don't help him? We got to give back what was given to us when we walked through those doors. And for the newcomers, I know some of you have been lied on, cheated, you've been talked about and mistreated. But if you would lie the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to do what they are designed to do, and when they land you back safely in the master's hands, he won't let you down. And I'm John, and I love y'all.